real great adventures of me, Tom Terrific, with
Mighty Manfred the Wonder Dog.
Ever. Terrific is the name for me, 'cause I'm so clever. I can be what I wanna be, and if you'd like to see, follow, come follow me. If you see a plane on high, a diesel train go roaring by, a bumblebee or a tree, it's me. When there is trouble, I'm there on the double, from Atlantic to Pacific. They know I'm terrific.
I'm Mighty Manfred, the Wonder Dog, and Tom's ever faithful companion.
Oh, I forgot to pause my intro. Terrible Tommy here. Yeah, in the bunker. Yeah, Wide Area and Resistance Radio Network here. We're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your notations, and it's almost time for April. Yeah, how about that? And then go up to resist.com, one of the, if not the best, racial website on the web, because we don't stick to right-wing claptrap. We go all over the place. We gather information wherever it's from that has to do with the betterment of the white race, whether it's ecology, whether it's finance, whether it's food, whether it's best interest from your health. We cover it all. I'm going to start out this morning with a hot one, in which this belongs to the tick, tick, tick area of the program. It's gradually coming to a head. Slowly but surely, gradually coming to head. And I think this story is going viral. And with that and Trump running for office and all that, Katie, bar the door shut, there's a man under the bed. It's going to get hotter than a depot stove in this country. Yeah.
George and Ferguson has boiled over and spread to other cities around the nation.
The roiling turbulence in Ferguson has boiled over and spread to other cities around the nation. That showed up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin this week, when community activists grew angry with their police force over an incident that happened last April. Officer Christopher Manny shot an African-American man who took the policeman's baton and attacked him with it. The man was mentally ill and died as a result of the encounter. And while Officer Manny was dismissed from the PD, he was never charged with a crime. Reporters were grilling the current police chief this week as he was in the midst of investigating yet more violence when he went completely off the politically correct script and shared his frustrations with the critics. Jake Tapper has the details. Tensions boiled over earlier this month at a public meeting on the case, where protesters lashed out at the police chief, accusing him of checking his phone while they voiced their concerns. After the meeting, the chief was asked about his actions, and his emotional response has now gone viral. "I was following developments of a five-year-old little girl who was sitting on her dad's lap and just got shot in the head by a drive-by shooting, and if some of the people here gave a good goddamn about the victimization of people in his community by crime, I'd take some of their invective more seriously," Milwaukee Police Chief Edward Flynn told reporters. 80% of my homicide victims every year are African American. 80% of our aggravated assault victims are African American. 80% of our shooting victims who survive their shootings are African American. Now they know all about the last three people killed by the Milwaukee Police Department over the course of the last several years. There's not one of them can name one of the last three homicide victims we've had in this city, Flynn said. "Now I'm leaving here to go to that scene. and I take it personally, okay, he said. The chief isn't saying anything that a lot of other frustrated citizens haven't already been expressing here. Mayors and city executives are fully aware that they get the occasional bad cop and that they have to move quickly when one is identified. But the vast, vast majority of police are out there doing an often thankless and frequently dangerous job. And while there are occasional encounters where police wind up resorting to deadly force, those numbers are microscopic compared to the number of criminals who are slaughtering citizens, including children, by the thousands in gang-infested areas. It's small wonder that Chief Flynn finally lost patience and spoke some unpopular truths. Unfortunately, there's more than a fair chance that the media will make sure he pays a price for it.
I heard a lot of things. Certainly there are some folks in this community that are legitimately grieving, and we heard from them. We heard a lot of folks who believe the First Amendment only applies to them and took great pains to shout down anybody that disagreed with them. Despite my ongoing disagreements with the police union, I have to say that their members tonight conducted themselves, I thought, with great restraint, given the ad hominem invective that was being unleashed on their work personally and the police department generally. So, you know, this is a controversy. This is a tragedy. I've said it over and over again. It's a tragedy for the family, tragedy for Officer Manning. It's a tragedy for the community. But I'm not blind to the fact that there's a lot of people lining up to take advantage of this tragedy to flog their own agendas, and that was clear tonight as well.
You're accused of saying something to one of the protesters or one of the people in the stands. He accused you of...
You know, he was making so much noise, I have no idea what he's talking about, but he feels insulted. Too bad.
What's your response to some of the people that thought you were being disrespectful by being on your phone and not being attentive to them?
Well, I was on my phone, and yes, that's true. I was following developments with a 5-year-old little girl sitting on her dad's lap who just got shot in the head by a drive-by shooting. And if some of the people here gave a good goddamn about the victimization of people in this community by crime, I take some of their invective more seriously. The greatest racial disparity in the city of Milwaukee is getting shot and killed. Hello. 80% of my homicide victims every year are African American. 80% of our aggravated assault victims are African American. 80% of our shooting victims who survived their shooting are African American. Now, they know all about the last 3 people that have been killed by the Milwaukee Police Department over the course of the last several years. There's not one of them can name one of the last 3 homicide victims we've had in this city. Now, there's room for everybody to participate in fixing this police department, and I'm not pretending we're without sin. But this community's at risk, all right. And it's not because men and women in blue risk their lives protecting it. It's at risk because we have large numbers of high-capacity, quality firearms in the hands of remorseless criminals who don't care who they shoot. Now, I'm leaving here to go to that scene. And I take it personally, okay? We're going up there, and there's a bunch of cops processing a scene of a dead kid. And they're the ones who are going to be out there patrolling and stopping suspects that may have guns under the front seat. They're the ones that are going to take the risks of their lives to try to clean this thing up. All right? We're responsible for the things we get wrong, and we take action. We've arrested cops, we've fired cops, and so on. But the fact is that the people out here, some of them, who had the most to say, are absolutely MIA when it comes to the true threats facing this community, and it gets a little tiresome. And when you start getting yelled at for reading the updates of the kid that gets shot, yeah, you take it personal, okay? Now, no offense, but I'm going up there now.
Well, this phony Black Lives Matter outfit is obviously engineered by some powerful forces behind it. And they want to drive a wedge between any of the community and the cops. And I liked what he said. It needs to be said. Should have been said a long time ago. This is part of my TikTok program. But eventually it's going to cause the boiling over big time in all the big cities. Just like it did back in the 60s. So we got to thank the Black Ku Klux Klan for that. They're doing a tremendous job there in Milwaukee, shooting little 5-year-old kids in the head. They're really doing a good job for Black Lives Matter. whenever you treat a group of people with kid gloves like they're almost above the law, they're going to do more and more, and it'll get worse and worse. And that may be good in the long run. We'll see how that goes. You see how it's working out in Europe. They baby all these immigrants coming in, baby all these young hooligan kind of guys, and finally it starts boiling over on them. This is the nature of things. It's the way it always works. And it only leads to, well, a readjustment, let's say that. We need a readjustment. Whatever happened to, not Malcolm X, but Farrakhan and his patrols that were going to help straighten out these black communities, areas, you know. How come there's no vigilante blacks straightening out their neighborhoods? And people coming out in the morning and seeing black drug pushers and black gang members dead in the gutter. And they could clean it up. There are plenty of blacks that could, in the black community, they could clean it up. But so far, they haven't done shit. Well, I mean, that's what you have to put up with when you're dealing with someone that's a race that's maybe a quarter of a million years behind. You can never expect them to be up to par on almost any subject. Well, it's time for the Pessimist's Guide to History. And it's exciting, I'm telling you. If you think you got things bad now, boy, the people in the past had it real bad. In 1851, the San Francisco fire, remember that? I was only 3 years old. Most residents of San Francisco were at home at 11 p.m. on May 3rd when a small fire broke out in a paint shop in Portsmouth Square. In minutes, fire enveloped the front of the building. Nearby structures, like most others in the city, were built of wood, all tinder dry, and to make matters worse, a breeze sprang up. Firemen responded quickly, but the windborne blaze spread out of control, and soon entire neighborhoods exploded into flames. Tens of thousands of terrified residents raced from their homes, sometimes only just ahead of the advancing fire. The fire continued for 2 days, stopping only when it reached the harbor. Even there, dock workers frantically chopped away burnt wharves and piers to protect ships at their moorings. When the fire finally burned itself out, it had claimed 30 lives and done more than $3.5 million in damage. Today, that'd be $1 billion. It won't be the last catastrophe to hit San Francisco. I think the last was the hippies. Yeah. In the day that George Lincoln Rockwell visited the docks. And a riot broke out. In 1852, Birkenhead sinks off Cape Town. On February 26th, the Birkenhead, a British frigate, powered by steam-driven paddle wheels, ran aground and sank at Danger Point near Cape Town in modern South Africa, niggerized South Africa. 455 of the 660 soldiers and crewmen aboard the ship died. Evidently, the captain's charts were not altogether accurate. You're kidding me. 1852, a fire hits Montreal, Canada. Sacrebleu, a blaze broke out in the poor section of Montreal, Canada. That must be where all those underground railroad with all those niggers ended up fleeing captivity in the horrible South to freeze their ass off in the horrible North. On July 9th, and quickly spread through the city. Before the blaze was extinguished, about 1,100 buildings were destroyed and some 15,000 people were left homeless. No deaths were reported. Well, at that point, there's quite a few guys named Rastus that probably said, shit, I'll go back to slavery rather than live in this stuff. My ass is freezing off and the front's burning off. 1853, Norwalk River Bridge Railroad accident. The New York and New Haven Line Express train failed to heed a warning signal and sped into an open drawbridge on May 6, sending the locomotive and four cars tumbling into the Norwalk River near South Norwalk, Connecticut. 46 passengers were injured in what was the worst U.S. railroad accident of that time. I'll bet it sure surprised the engineer. 1854, the city of Glasgow, Scotland, disappears at sea. Oh, not the real city. The steamship City of Glasgow departed from Liverpool on March 1st, bound for Philadelphia, with 373 people aboard. The steamer and all aboard disappeared without a trace sometime during the Atlantic crossing, and they have never found the ship. I know it was a flying saucer got them, man. 1854, charge of the Light Brigade. During the siege of Sevastopol in the Crimean War, an overzealous British captain apparently misinterpreted his orders on purpose. As a result, the British Light Brigade consisted at that point of 607 horsemen armed only with swords. Were ordered on October 25th to attack a far superior Russian force made up of six divisions of cavalry and six battalions of infantry and 30 cannons. Without hesitation, the Light Brigade ranged themselves in two lines and began to advance, quickening their pace as they drew closer to the enemy. The Ruskies opened up with 30 cannons when the British were still 1,200 yards away. The furious volleys failed to stop the Light Brigade. The cavalrymen only closed their ranks as comrades fell wounded and dead. At last, reaching the line of the artillery, the cavalrymen hacked down the gunners where they stood or drove them away, then charged through a column of Russian infantry and scattered them. Wow. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, Russian guns mounted on hills opened fire from above. The Russian lancers attacked from the flank, their sabers flashing furiously. The British attempted to cut their way through the enemy forces and were about to succeed when the Russians began firing grapeshot and canisters into the melee, killing both their own men and the British cavalry. Of 607 members of the Light Brigade, only 198 made it back to their own lines. Just 25 minutes after the calamitous charge began. The battle was later celebrated in Tennyson's Charge of the Light Brigade, thus bringing immortality to the gallant men who allowed an arrogant captain's orders. Yeah, that's right. You know, that reminds me, if Stalin hadn't gotten rid of his best officers prior to Hitler's attack through a purge, the Soviet army could have stopped the Germans almost before they got started into Russia. But Stalin is another one of these assholes that thought he knew it all, and he wanted to take over the military. So he had to purge and wiped out, I think it was hundreds of his best officers, which almost cost them the war. Yeah. Let's see. Clipper ship sinks in an ice field. The Guiding Star, a clipper ship carrying 480 passengers and crew on an Atlantic crossing, sailed into a massive ice field on January 9th and disappeared. These icebergs will prove to be very hazardous to the health of transatlantic passengers. Which should remind everybody, don't fuck with Mother Nature. She doesn't like that. Well, let's check in on some hate crimes here and see what's happening. Boy, they're pushing those all over the place, so watch it out there.
Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Lammer Sandridge said he couldn't remember the...
Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Lammer Sandridge said he couldn't remember the assault that left him with a broken orbital bone. I couldn't see out of one eye for a couple of days, said Sandridge, of Dubuque, adding that he was on a liquid diet for several days due to his swollen cheek. Police said Sandridge was repeatedly stomped and kicked by Randy J. Metcalf, 40, while Sandridge laid unconscious on the floor of Northside Bar, 2776, Jackson St. in January, 2015. A jury trial started today for Metcalf, who was indicted on a federal hate crime charge in November. Investigators said Metcalf attacked Sandridge, who is black, and repeatedly used racial slurs. But Metcalf's attorney said the fight was not racially motivated and Metcalf was attempting to protect his fiancée. The trial will continue Tuesday in the United States District Court for the Northern District of Iowa. According to court documents, Sandridge was at Northside Bar with Katie Flores and Sarah Keene, both of whom are white. The group got into an argument with Metcalf's group over a jukebox at around 11 p.m., but the argument quickly was settled. However, at around 1:15 a.m., there was a brawl in which Sandridge was repeatedly punched by Joseph M. Sanders, 22, of Dubuque and left lying on the ground, according to court documents. During opening statements Monday, Assistant the United States Attorney Anthony Morfitt said Metcalf continued attacking a defenseless and vulnerable Sandridge. Metcalf walks up to the defenseless and vulnerable Lammer and kicks his head and stomps his head, and kicks his head and stomps his head, and kicks his head and stomps his head, Morfitt said. Flores testified Monday that she, Keene and Sandridge first were approached by Metcalf, who accused them of using jukebox credits paid for by his fiancée, Noelle S. Weyaker. Flores said she apologized and gave him money to avoid conflict. She said Metcalf insulted her then, but she couldn't recall the exact phrase he used. Ted Stackies, the owner of Northside Bar, testified that he intervened in the jukebox dispute and shortly afterwards spoke with Metcalf alone. Stackies said Metcalf mentioned being involved in cross burnings in Dubuque and showed off a swastika tattoo on his stomach. Stackies said Metcalf also made racist remarks such as "I hate those," expletive, dot. "It made me nervous," Stackies said. "It intimidated me." Stackies said he considered calling police. But Metcalf's attorney, Melanie Kuiper, noted Stackies and Metcalf had smoked marijuana together behind the bar. Stackies said he hadn't. Sandridge said he remembered the argument over the jukebox, and telling Metcalf not to curse at and insult Flores and Keene. "Metcalf and I squashed the situation, shook hands, and went our separate ways," Sandridge testified. Sandridge said he doesn't remember anything between the jukebox incident and waking up in the emergency room later. Flores said Metcalf repeatedly used racist and derogatory remarks, making her angry. When another argument broke out at 1:15 a.m., Flores said she saw Weyaker recording the incident on a cell phone and knocked it out of Weyaker's hand. Metcalf charged her after that, Flores said. "Everyone went to the ground," she said. "It was complete chaos." Bartender Becky Burks testified that she attempted to break up the fight and shield Sandridge from being attacked. She also testified that Metcalf used racial slurs toward Sandridge, Flores, and Keene. Jeremy Sanders, 41, of Dubuque, also testified that Metcalf used racial slurs and showed off his swastika tattoo. Surveillance footage shown during the trial appeared to show Metcalf lifting up his shirt and showing something to both Stackies and Jeremy Sanders. Jeremy Sanders said he put Sandridge in a headlock during the brawl and asked his son Joseph Sanders to stop punching Sandridge. He said Metcalf spent the night at his place after the fight. Metcalf just said nigger man got what was coming to him, Sanders said, noting that Metcalf used a racial slur rather than black man. Both Jeremy Sanders and Joseph Sanders pleaded guilty in Iowa District Court to assault with injury for their involvement in the fight. Both were given suspended one-year jail sentences and 2 years of probation. Kuiper said Flores kept egging Metcalf on after the initial argument. Kuiper said Metcalf only went after Flores after seeing her assault Wayaker. Kuiper said there's no dispute a fight took place. The question is whether it was a simple bar fight or racially motivated, as the prosecution claims, she said. You have to determine why the assault took place, Kuiper told jurors.
So you see, these U.S. attorneys are primed and waiting and waiting in the dark for anything racially so-called motivated, or even if it's not motivated, to turn it into motivation. And this, of course, is intimidation of white men, heterosexual men, to cower down in front of nigger predators, and especially when they're messing with their women and so forth. And this is why you have to be very careful when you're out, especially in a bar, drinking and so forth. However, if it's out in the street or down a dark alley, who knows what might happen. I would hope that someday these U.S. attorneys go to a bar and have a problem, and some nigger beat the shit out of these white con men, U.S. attorneys. And that's probably going to happen in a upscale cocktail lounge, you know. Now, the federales think that this is going to solve a problem, but it's not. It's going to make the problem worse. Because when you add more time due to this hate crime stuff because the guy's white and because he fought a black or something like that, believe me, it's going to add to the anger and the vitriol of white heterosexual males. So, thanks a lot, Federals. Thanks a lot, Obamsky people. It's going to backfire on you. Well, I'm sure you heard on the news. I heard it last night when it just happened that a Nashville area man shot by police Monday after allegedly wielding a gun at the U.S. Capitol Visitor Center has had multiple brushes with the law in recent years, including in Washington, D.C., where he was arrested last fall after proclaiming himself a prophet of God inside the House of Representatives. You see what religious insanity brings you to? And, of course, didn't take much for this guy. He's blacker than the ace of spades. I wonder if they're going to charge him with a hate crime. Oh, that'll be the day. They're never going to do that. Larry Russell Dawson, a 66-year-old nigger of Antioch, is known locally as a one-time funeral director who lost his license for burying people in the wrong spot or not burying them at all. A Williamson County's bus driver fired for harassing a teenage girl, making sexual advances, of which he was never charged with a hate crime, and a self-styled church pastor who launched a fundraising campaign in the name of raising the federal minimum wage. Wow. There's got to be more to this story. Dawson was transported to a Washington hospital after he was shot by the U.S. racist U.S. Capitol Police. He was stable but in critical condition Monday night, according to the Associated Press. USCP Chief Matthew Verderosa, sounds Hispanic, noted that Dawson had been known to frequent the Capitol grounds. He hung around. He was arrested in October for disrupting the proceedings in the House and was charged with assaulting a police officer and unlawful conduct on Capitol grounds. According to D.C. court records, he was released but never appeared in court. A bench warrant was issued November 19th for his arrest. See, niggers get away with all kinds of stuff. The episode was the latest in a series of legal issues involving Dawson dating back to at least 20 years. Dawson filed for bankruptcy in 1996 and between 2000 and 2012 accrued 16 tax liens and small claims judgments against him, a record show. You see, if you a nigger, you get away with a lot of stuff. I've got a song about that. I'll have to dig it out. I wish I was a nigger. Beginning in the 1980s, Dawson worked on and off as a bus driver for Williamson County Schools, spokesman Carol Birdsong said. During that time, he also worked as a part-time cafeteria worker. He was fired in the spring of 2001 after his arrest on harassment charges of a teenage girl. Dawson, who was arrested on a misdemeanor charge of harassing in writing, wrote a letter on August 8, 2003, professing his love for a teenage girl and his desire for her to become his wife and have his child. The Tennessean reported at that time. Dawson was arrested on identical charge in March 2002 for sending the same girl more inappropriate letters. Here's some more. In one of those letters, he claimed God told him to contact the girl and ask her to come live with him. According to Tennessee Bureau of Investigation criminal records, Dawson was found not guilty reason of insanity on two of the three harassment charges and acquitted on the third. I'll tell you, I wished I was a nigger, man. I could get away with everything. Still, the arrest would prove to haunt Dawson in the years that followed. In 1972, he was licensed as a funeral director in Tennessee, said Kevin Waters, spokesman for the state's Department of Commerce and Insurance, which oversees the licensing board. Dawson's license expired on June 30, 2004, and the State Board of Funeral Directors, Embalmers, and Burial Services denied his reapplication for a license at least three times, including 2008, 2009, and 2014. I think there was a rumor they caught him screwing a corpse or something. I'm not sure of that. In each instance, Dawson was denied a license on the grounds of moral character due to an incident when Dawson was a bus driver in Williamson County, Walters said. Apparently, Mr. Dawson wrote a letter to an underage girl telling her that God told him to have sex with her, Walters said. So the board denied in those instances. During 2014 funeral board hearing, Dawson reverenced his ministry and once again claimed he was doing what he believed God told him to do. If you claim you're a preacher, you can get away with about anything. Any time that a minister is being led by God and he gave you direct commands to do something, it's left up to you to do it and or not to do it. Well, there's quite a bit more here to this poor fool, but I'm not going to go on into it. You get the message. Since they're half nuts anyhow, millions of Negroes are using poor me defenses and getting out of crimes. And it's the white people who are letting them loose and not punishing them. Well, a recent poll says that 50% of the Italians call themselves Catholic. And also, in another poll, a surprising 20% said they were atheists in this Catholic stronghold. 20% of the Italians are atheists. They're beginning to wise up. I was going to play something for you about this new right-wing Breitbart network that's got all these Harvard graduates and big bank, ex-bank employees working for it. And it's a false flag, but it's really taken off fast, got a lot of money behind it, sucking in these conservatives. Well, I've got something I want to play for you, and you can hear for yourself what the founder of the Breitbart idea and network had to say about the idea of race. Oh, yes, and before I forget it, today they arrested the campaign manager for Donald Trump. What for? A reporter from Breitbart News tried to muscle in up to Trump as he was walking away from his speaking engagement, and his campaign manager took her by the arm and pulled her aside to pull her away. And now she's sued, and he is under arrest. And that's your great right-wing Breitbart network.
I've been called a racist more times than you can possibly imagine, when my entire reason for being is to end racism, to make it so that black people and Hispanics in this country have the freedom to think like they want to think.
From the Global News Network of Breitbart.com, this is Breitbart News Daily.
Well, Mr. False Flag Breitbart Network, I'd like to ask you a question. Since when can a person think what he wants to think? You may not be allowed to say what you want to say, or write what you want to write, or anything like that. But blacks, even under slavery, they could think what they wanted to think. Okay, you can go about your business of trying to stomp out racism, Mr. Breitbart, but don't expect any of my friends to support your network.
Andrew Oerenheimer describes himself as a white nationalist hacktivist, wears a swastika tattoo on his chest and has espoused neo-Nazi beliefs. Oerenheimer, who went to prison for his role in the 2010 AT&T data breach, is behind the cyber attack that printed flyers on printers and fax machines at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, Smith College, and Mount Holyoke College last week, New Jersey Advance Media reported on Monday. I've been a longtime critic of Judaism, black culture, immigration to Western nations, and the media's constant stream of anti-white propaganda, reads an article he penned in 2014 for the Daily Stormer, a neo-Nazi website with a name that is now familiar in Western Massachusetts. The Daily Stormer is the website promoted during a cyber attack on Thursday against colleges across the country. Oerenheimer, known online by the handle Weave, admitted he was responsible in a post on the website Storify, which goes on to explain how he pulled it off in minute technical detail. It also asks for money so the attacks can continue and credits one of the Daily Stormer crew with creating the flyer's design. On Thursday, printers at the colleges suddenly spewed out a flyer adorned with swastikas, addressed to white men, and decrying the degeneracy of the Jews. It encourages the reader to join the struggle for global white supremacy by visiting the Daily Stormer. UMassHateFlyer.jpg. The flyer sent to area schools, including UMass Amherst, last week. So who is Weave? Why did he do it? And how? In the AT&T breach case, Weave revealed the email addresses of 114,000 iPad users by exploiting a security flaw. The hackers, calling themselves Goatsy Security, wrote at the time that all data was gathered from a public web server with no password, accessible by anyone on the Internet. In court documents, Prosecutors used stronger language, calling it a brute force attack. Court documents also contain contemporary quotes from Weave, posted online, admitting his participation. Oernheimer was released in 2014, about a year into his 41-month prison sentence, after an appeals court vacated his conviction, saying the Arkansas man should not have been tried in New Jersey. He now resides in the partially recognized Eastern European country of Abkhazia, according to New Jersey Advance Media. During his time in Pennsylvania's Allenwood Federal Correctional Complex, Oernheimer said he spent hours scrawling on the walls of his cell and reciting the Nordic poetic works known as Edda. He also said he billed the judge and prosecutor for the time he'd spent behind bars, but they didn't pay his invoice. In his screed explaining how he pulled off last week's cyber attack, Weave mocks the media, the students, and staff who were offended, people of color and those who tweeted about it. Some of this comes in the form of direct insults targeted at individuals. One such aside finds Weave declaring that he can't think of an apt slur to use against UMass Amherst Chancellor Kumbhal R. Subbaswamy, who is of Indian heritage, and challenging him to a fight. Weave refers to many of the outraged comments as hilarious. The post ends with a solicitation of funds for the development of my Eastern European laboratory of ruin. He explains how the attack was achieved, identifying printers that are accessible online and using a technique called a bash one-liner to send an order to print an image. Weave said he chose the swastika because it's a Unicode symbol, meaning most printers can reproduce it. If he had tried something more complex, like a cartoon, more printers may have rejected his commands. Phone messages left for the UMass Amherst Police Department and the FBI were not immediately returned.
Basically, this guy did a lot of good work. I question him being connected to Sturmer, because that is regressive National Socialism. In other words, backwards. It's not advancing. It's not adding new concepts and new thinking. But I do commend this young man for his ability, and he pulled it off. And he had the courage to do it and go to jail for it. Maybe someday I'll get over there to that country, whatever it is, and Eastern Europe and visit him. After seeing the creator of Disturmer sitting around a table drinking with four Filipino women, I just don't think I can have too much confidence in his form of National Socialism. It will just suffice to say it's regressive National Socialism, more like quasi-capitalism dressed up as a Hollywood Nazi.
Orono, Maine, AP, the University of Maine is among several universities across the country that has received anti-Semitic flyers sent to their network-connected printers and fax machines. The Portland Press Herald reports UMaine officials posted an alert on the Orono School's website explaining that the racist flyers were sent to campus printers last week, including two that were sent out from printers in the student union on Friday. Anti-Defamation League representatives say it appears that a neo-Nazi group hacked into schools' information systems. Officials say this kind of cyber attack may be a new tactic utilized by hate groups. The flyers, which specifically targeted Jewish people and included links to a neo-Nazi website, began popping up at schools last Thursday. Campus police and technology officials are investigating.
Yeah, I bet they are investigating. Come on, hackers, go. We're a totally hacker-supporting outfit. Free hackers, yeah. It's amazing how they latched on to key terms and use them no matter what. Neo-Nazi, stuff like that. They just love those terms. no Nazis in this country that I know of. Even the Nazi Party never used neo-Nazi. If they were going to use Nazi, it would be Nazi, period. They're Nazis, like George Lincoln Rockwell's party. But these people have broadened it out now to show what liars and rats they are. They call everybody that has any feelings about race at all a neo-Nazi. Yeah, and they have, you know, several other terms. Now, oh, everything's hate. Never anything intelligent and respectful and love. Like nobody who believes in race ever says anything that's worthwhile. That's good. I wish they would push it more, because nothing builds resistance like persecution and insults and so forth. Great, do it. Come on, Jews, come on. Come on, you Jew-like Christians. Go on, pour it on, baby. You haven't shown me much yet. Show me something. Lone wolves can take it, I'm telling you. They can take it. If they can't take it, get out of the kitchen. Yeah. And the funny part about it is the prisons are producing more lone wolves every day. You throw them into prison for little things, and then they come out. They come out neo-Nazis. Oh, you guys are funny. Progressives are funny. Jews are funny. Jewish Christians are funny. It's pretty funny. It's a George Carlin world.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I'd like to begin. Thank you. I'd like to begin by saying, fuck Lance Armstrong. Fuck him and his balls and his bicycles and his steroids and his yellow shirts and the dumb, empty expression on his face. I'm tired of that asshole. And while you're at it, fuck Tiger Woods, too. There's another jack-off I can do without. I'm tired of being told who to admire in this country. Aren't you sick of being told who your heroes ought to be? Being told who you ought to be looking up to. I'll choose my own heroes, thank you very much. And fuck Dr. Phil, too.
Well, according to an article in the Orlando Sentinel, Florida experienced a swell of gun range suicides in recent years, pushing many gun ranges in the state to end gun rentals to customers. One gun range owned by theorized men who had come to the ranges to end their lives so that their families wouldn't have to clean up the scene at their home. The article cited research that had been at Harvard School for Public Health by Catherine Barber, directors of the Injury Control Research Center. Barber found that 51 gun range suicides out of about 30,000 shooting suicides reported by 16 states from 2005 to 2010. And I'm sure it's a lot more now, because I'll bet you a lot of these are Middle East veterans, Army veterans, Marine veterans. Yeah, I'll bet they are. And I'll bet you most of them are white, too.
The People's Party are Slovakia, LSNS, a far-right radical Marian Kotelba won one-fourth of the vote in the recent election in the Slovak village Ostrigrun, which was massacred by the Nazis in 1945, the Czech weekly magazine Reflex has written in its latest issue. I was shocked. I would have never imagined that a party that claims allegiance to the wartime Slovak state would succeed in our village, Ostrigrun Mayor Jana Angeltova said. The LSNS won over 8% of the vote in the general election held on March 5 and it entered parliament. In January 1945, the Nazi Germans claimed that the locals supported resistance fighters. They burnt the village down and shot dead 64 civilians, including 26 women and 12 children. The descendants of the victims call the massacre the Bloody Sunday. The locals who did not vote for the LSNS cannot understand why somebody would support Kotelba, who can be labeled a neo-Nazi. It took me by surprise. But it seems that people don't connect Kotelba with fascism. He changed his behavior and his vocabulary. The people do not take into account that he has fascist tendencies. Even though he had people who support Adolf Hitler among the candidates, Ostrigrund Deputy Mayor Miroslav Sejit said. Sejit said the election result in the village was a warning. He said the annual remembrance events need to be done in a different way. We don't appeal to the young generation. It seems that we must change the way in which we remember the events from the end of the war. A mass and laying of wreaths are not enough, he told Reflex. It is practically impossible to find anybody who voted for Kotelba in the small village. People refuse to talk about it. The locals watch one another with suspicion and speculate who could have supported a party with such a radical and extremist program, the weekly writes. We don't have any Romanis in the village. No skinheads march here, and none of our citizens is a member of Kotelba's party. But people still voted for him. I think it was out of defiance. They wanted to show their protest, Sejit said. Available analyses indicate that up to 35% of Kotelba's voters supported him because of the anti-corruption and social program of his party. However, the LSNS has no such program, Reflex writes. The 38-year-old Kotelba won over many voters because of his hatred for Brussels and NATO, because he preferred Slovak products to foreign ones, and because he promised to force out thieves from parliament and parasites from gypsy settlements, the magazine writes. Kotelba has been the governor of the Banská Bystrica region since 2013. But if his voters watched his actions, they would see that he does the things that he criticizes in other politicians. He turned the governor's office into a family business and the headquarters of his party, Reflex writes. The Slovak branch of the Transparency International NGO documented that Kotelba's office placed public orders to LSNS members and affiliated entrepreneurs, Reflex writes. But his voters do not mind this. They mind neither Holocaust denial, nor the celebration of the Slovak puppet state, nor conspiracy theories about the influence of Jews, the Weekly says. These people have their everyday troubles and they don't know how to deal with them. They are often strongly troubled by the Romani issue. Kotelba is not exclusively supported by right-wing extremists, Focus polling agency director Martin Slujeric said. The last eyewitness of the 1945 massacre is Anna Novikova, who does not talk to people anymore, due to her serious illness. I preferred not to tell her the election resulted here. The Bloody Sunday is the trauma of her life, her daughter-in-law said. When remembering the tragedy some time ago, Novikova said, the still bodies of my parents, my sister, and brother were lying on me. Their bodies saved my life. I was shot in the leg, and when the Nazi commando left, I clawed my way from under the corpses and survived. Angeltova is a descendant of the massacre. Her father was 1 year old then, and he survived because his parents hid him under the sheets before they were both shot dead by the Germans. Elderly people, the survivors, feel it was an evil that keeps concerning us. An evil that we have survived. They consider Kotelba a neo-Nazi, Angeltova said. But the young generation has a different view. And support from young people was crucial for Kotelba. When the Slovak Institute for Public Affairs organized test elections at secondary schools last year, Kotlba ended in the second position and won support from 16% of 12,000 students. As a former IT teacher, Kotlba realized that young people do not read newspapers, listen to the radio or watch TV, but that they seek information on internet and social networking websites. The LSNS Facebook profile has 70,000 supporters, which makes it the second most popular party in the country. Kotlba's personal Facebook profile has 60,000 fans and it presents no information about the fascist past of Slovakia, Reflex writes. War history is slowly moving out of the knowledge of young people. This is why it does not seem odd to them to vote for Kotlba, Angeltova said. 3 years ago, more than a half of surveyed Slovak secondary school students did not know who were the leaders of the wartime Slovak state and how many Jews they sent to concentration camps, Reflex writes. Historical memory should be clear in case of Austrie Grun, but it is not. Something is wrong. People do not feel the threat that something similar might be repeated, said Stanislav Misev, director of the Museum of the Slovak National Uprising. The stone memorial in Austrie Grun has a sign telling the path is sprayed with our blood, do not abandon it. Those who gave their votes to Kotlba have abandoned it, Reflex writes.
Well, of course there's always two sides to the story. We only get one side almost all the time. I'm sure bad things happened to good people during World War II on all sides, that's for sure. But this is a new day and there's new problems, but some of the opposition and the enemies are the same old ones that we met before. Isn't that surprising? Well, let's take a little jaunt over to Great Britain and see what the boys are doing over there.
As neo-Nazis and anti-fascists prepare to head to Dover this weekend, Ed Goddard takes a look at the importance of violence as a tool in the anti-racist toolkit both in the struggles of the past and present. The far right are mobilizing yet again for a demo in Dover and yet again anti-fascists are heading to the south coast town intent on stopping them. The day looks set to be a repeat of January's chaotic events, which saw hundreds of anti-fascists and openly neo-Nazi demonstrators clash, throwing punches and paving stones with serious injuries racked up on both sides. While the left is comfortable decrying fascist violence, it is noticeably more unsure when it comes to its own. Those who dish out beatings to far-right mobs are ritually accused of stooping down to their level, of being as bad as the fascists, or even of actually being left-wing fascists themselves for successfully using violence against their political opponents. Though in a sense understandable due to the nasty nature of violence and the fact we're often the first to condemn it in the form of wars or police brutality, it fails to take into account the nature of the racist gangs mobilizing for Dover, not to mention the current threat to multiculturalism one in Britain, as well as across Europe. Moreover, it completely ignores the significant role violence played in establishing multiculturalism as a reality in so many British cities in the first place, that, as well as promoting peaceful coexistence, anti-racism too has always involved physical opposition, whether organized in racist groups or not, to those who would threaten that coexistence. The nature of the enemy. First up, it needs to be said that the groups coming out for Dover are not your traditional right-wing nationalist political parties. They're not like UKIP, they're not even much like the BNP under Nick Griffin, and the difference isn't just over politics. The key difference is practice. While even hard-right political parties focus primarily on seeming respectable to try and win at the ballot box, these groups reject respectability in favor of a focus on violent street confrontations. A successful demo is one where members get pissed and start aggro with counter-demonstrators or, failing that, any non-white locals. Yet this is what people misunderstand about these groups, laughing at them for being inarticulate pissheads who couldn't string a sentence together let alone influence government policy. But their goal isn't to affect policy or produce provocative think pieces for the spectator. Their goal is to intimidate. Their organizational model is not the political party, it's the hooligan firm. This is why an approach that rejects physical confrontation cannot work, why even chanting "there are many, many more of us than you" makes no sense. The Southeast Alliance have the words "sometimes outnumbered, never outgunned" emblazoned on a St. George's cross. They love being outnumbered as long as they get home safe enough to brag about it. It validates their self-image as brave defenders of the nation taking on crowds of irate, though ultimately soft, student lefties. More than being outnumbered, the politics they understand is when they are out-violenced. Indeed, so comprehensively out-violenced that they can't even put a brave face on social media, as they will inevitably always try to. Nazis duck missiles as they are held behind police lines for their own safety during failed white man march in Liverpool, 2015. So events like Liverpool in 2015, when National Action ended up hiding in a lost luggage department for their safety while a multi-ethnic crowd of Scousers chucked bananas at them, or Walthamstow 2012 when the EDL's march was blocked by crowds hurling bottles and bricks and chanting "if it wasn't for the coppers you'd be dead." Events like these rupture their hardman self-image. They set off organizational disarray and internal recriminations as they start rowing amongst each other about who ballsed up what and who's never turning up again to anything organized by whoever else. And they discourage those who were thinking about coming down for a laugh in a ruck, when they realize the reality means being shepherded behind police lines for their own safety or taking a kicking as their mates run for their own safety. Fighting racism, a historical snapshot. All this is nothing new. Yet to a large extent contemporary anti-racism has been sanitized, reduced in the popular imagination to "I have a dream" and Benetton adverts, or worse, not being able to order a black coffee in case someone gets offended. Even the collective memory of Nelson Mandela makes him seem just a kindly old man who once met the Spice Girls rather than a communist revolutionary who spent 27 years in prison for involvement in an underground guerrilla organization. Yes, it's true that multiculturalism was created by the increasing interactions, cultural, social, romantic, between people of different ethnicities and, yes, it's true that those interactions have been based on basic humanitarian principles like peace, love, and unity. But it must always be remembered that those interactions and those principles had to be defended and the capacity to use violence against those who would threaten them played a significant part in that defense. So when fascists attacked London's black community during the 1958 Notting Hill race riots, themselves thought to have been triggered by a group of white people attacking an interracial couple, the West Indian community formed its own self-defense groups. As Jamaican community activist and participant, Baker Barron, describes, quote, "The men, well, we were armed. During the day they went out and got milk bottles, got what they could find and got the ingredients of making the Molotov cocktail bombs. Make no mistake, there were iron bars. There were machetes, there were all kinds of arms, weapons, we had guns. Black man is searched by police during the Notting Hill riots, 1958. 18 years later, Notting Hill's black community would again be on the front line fighting racism on the streets. Black youth revolted, this time against racist policing at the 1976 Notting Hill Carnival, resulting in officers taking a real hammering, knocked over like ninepins by volleys of bricks and bottles. And almost exactly a year after Notting Hill, it would be the National Front's turn to feel the full force of militant anti-racist mobilization as they attempted to march through Lewisham. Anti-fascist activist Steve Tilsey recounts his memories of the day in which, apart from one group of Nazis being pummeled to the ground by fists and boots, quote, all along the route of the march the NF were getting serious problems as fighting and skirmishing broke out between the two sides. At one point the march was smashed completely in half as hundreds of anti-Nazis broke through the ranks of police and engaged the front in vicious hand-to-hand fighting. An anti-fascist lays into a National Front member during protests in Lewisham, 1977. All these represent the fight of communities, whether against the encroachment of fascist groups or of racist police, to exist both socially and culturally in Britain. Yet even these remain a handful of spectacular events in the history of anti-racism in Britain. While multiculturalism took root among those who welcomed it in those environments where different ethnicities mixed freely, it was imposed on those who didn't want it through thousands, or hundreds of thousands, potentially millions even, of minor scuffles, struggles, and conflicts whose only record is in the memories of those who experienced them. One such memory is that of my older sister who remembers being slapped in the face by an older white boy for playing football with a group of black kids in the park behind our house when she was little, which must have been as late as the early 1990s. They leapt to her defense, gave the boy a slap and chased him off. My sister continued playing in the park, as did I when I got older, but I don't ever remember seeing that boy. I don't include this anecdote because it's particularly exciting. I sometimes even wonder whether the kids who backed my sister up even remember it. The opposite, actually, to show the kind of everyday physical defense of simple coexistence which took place in British cities in order for multiculturalism to become a reality. Those kids fought for their right, and my sister's right, to play with whoever they want in our area. The innumerable stories of playground punch UPS and public altercations which won't make history books, in large part because there are just too many of them and their unspectacular nature make them interesting only to those who know those involved. When looked at together, however, as part of a generalized fight back or movement, they become more interesting. The Fantastic Young Rebels documentary on the Southall Youth Movement does just this in recording some of these stories of young Asians growing up in 1970s to 80s Britain. One SIM member, Jagdish Banger, remembers coming out of class, all these white people just jumped on me, started beating me up and there was another Jamaican boy with me, and he ran off and I thought ah, that's nice. But what he did 2 minutes later, he came back with a load of Jamaican black people and we had such a big scuffle. In the same documentary, Jaswant Hunjan recalls, quote, we were young, we formed a gang. And like, what the skinheads were doing, they always shouted we're going packy bashing today. We're going packy bashing today. So we were going skinhead bashing. Cause most of the time, at night time, they'll come, in cars and everything, you know, just to swear at us, and find someone on his own and beat him up. Well, there was quite a few of us and, we just stood round corners with bottles and bricks and when you see the cars coming, let it go. The struggles which Southall Youth Movement members engaged in with local racists were inseparable from the wider issues of racism the group took up. Indeed, it was the assault and murder of Gurdip Singh Chagger by a racist gang that led to the group's creation, with its dedication to physically keeping racism off the streets of Southall as well as the lack of youth provision in the borough. The climax of Southall's youth activism came in 1981 when the community stopped a far-right skinhead concert, torching the pub it was due to be held in and attacking fascists while police were helpless to stop them. As Jagdish Banger explains, it was a proud moment, we stood up for ourselves saying we're Southall. Yes, all right, it's full of Indians but we stood up for ourselves. Facing the threat ahead, not just with violence, but certainly not without it. For anyone who opposes racism, there seems an endless cause for alarm these days. In Britain, UKIP finished the election with almost 4 million votes, 27% of the total and the third highest of any party. Meanwhile, hate crimes between 2014 and 2015 increased 18% and Islamophobic attacks in London went up a worrying 70% while EDL splinter groups are able to mobilize hundreds for demonstrations under Nazi flags for the first time since the early 1990s. The rest of Europe is equally worrying, if not more so. Greek neo-fascists Golden Dawn remain the third most popular party while continuing to carry out attacks on migrants. Xenophobic Eastern European governments continue to use barbed wire fences and the inflammatory language of invasion to keep out refugees. In Calais, France, fascist groups frequently abduct, strip and beat refugees living in the jungle encampment while French police frequently make incursions with batons and tear gas while between 2014 and 2015 Germany saw a 500% increase in attacks against refugee centers. And with every ISIS terror attack such jingoistic nationalism becomes further entrenched. While there was never any golden age of multiculturalism, we certainly are seeing a return to cruder, more explicit, which in turn enable more vicious, forms of racism. This is not to say that violence is the only true form of anti-racism or that the problem of racism can be tackled only with violence. In the end, the only long-term solution is to build a movement which can oppose both the racist narrative and the social injustices it conceals. A task which involves a wide range of activities and tactics. But while there are those who act out the politics of race, with all the violence it entails, there will be those who will respond in kind. Multiculturalism may have been created in the spirit of peaceful coexistence, but it was defended with a violence strong enough to overpower its enemy.
Well, for the National Front, which I was associated with somewhat, and that's how that all got started in the late 70s, early 80s. But one thing the right wing has never learned properly is street action. They are quite naive about street action and tactics, of which these tactics are readily available through manuals and even ancient history. So anyhow, when I had my marches and riots or whatever, we had tactics. We had strategic tactics. We had things laid out, and we won. It's too bad that the Brits went into these things just sort of like either a straight out parade that gets broken into with not pre-arrangements made to counteract it. Or they go in sort of like a mob going down the street, but a non-correct strategic mob. they could have always won in all these places where the where these non-whites and their even worse white allies would attack. They could have always been smashed if the right tactics. You don't have to have the majority in the streets. You just don't have to have it. A minority in the streets using the right tactics can win every time. Now, of course, you got to deal with the cops. But as time goes on, the cops are going to have to be dealing with their own problems. And they're not going to be able to recruit enough people to be cops. But anyhow, I hope the Brits do well. I don't know if it was last week in Dover or coming up this next week in Dover, but I hope they do it a different way than they usually do it. And like I say, the strategies are all around. We used to use a diamond formation, a V formation, different things like that. Anyhow, it's quite interesting. Of course, this whole thing I just played was the opposition. It was the opposition. But I think they pretty much throwing their hands up in the air and saying they couldn't break our racial forces by force. And so they want to try something else. Well, to form a movement, it's a waste of time. It's not enough time left. Anyhow, that's it from here, and we'll be back tomorrow. I may have a show that's going to be recorded tomorrow morning with a person offshore that has a radio show in another country, so we'll see whether I'll use that. Okie dokie. 14 words and 5. I have nothing to say. One last thought. The Abrahamic religions cause most of the problems or a strong part of our problems in the whole of Europe and the whole of other white countries. You got to remember that. They, with all their people going around trying to recruit people into the Christian faith or the Muslim faith and that, they draw a reaction. And that causes big problems. So the mythical bullshit of the Abrahamic-based parties is bad for the white race.